It's now 8 years since the fall of the Taliban government in Afghanistan, and the insurgency is still raging. We've had innumerable chats on the program in the past with Americans and Australian strategists working in the country. But tonight we're looking at the problem from a different angle. Yes, the Dutch. They've been an important part of the NATO operations in Afghanistan, working alongside Australians, covering our back in many ways, in one of the most problematic parts of the country. Now, my next guest is one of the authors of an independent report evaluating Dutch strategy and comparing it to the US and the Australian approaches. And the findings are fascinating. Suzanne Schmedel is co-founder and a senior advisor to the Tribal Liaison Office in Afghanistan, and she's also a visiting fellow at the Asia Pacific College on Diplomacy at the Australian National University. Welcome to our Sydney studio, Suzanne, and let's begin by you explaining to me, in words of one syllable, what exactly the Tribal Liaison Office does.
Okay. Actually, I have to quickly say that we recently changed our name to the Liaison Office due to local politics in Afghanistan. And
This is a case of cultural sensitivity, which we'll be talking about later.
Or like non-governmental sensitivity, more likely. Yeah. Basically, what the Liaison Office is trying to do is trying to find a role for traditional customary structures in the peace and reconstruction process of Afghanistan.
And that, of course, is central and vital, as we'll discuss as this chat progresses. Tell me about the province in Afghanistan on which you're focused.
We started out in the southeast of Afghanistan, which is Paktia, Paktika, and Khost. And now we also work in the south in Kandahar and, of course, Uruzgan, and also in the east in Nangarhar.
Okay, can you describe the difference between the Dutch approach and the US approach in these particular parts of Afghanistan?
I have to start that we mainly evaluated the Dutch approach and somewhat compare it. So the Dutch approach differs very much, in my opinion, from the others, as that I would classify it as a do-no-harm approach. The Dutch are, in the words of a local, they're called the moderist, while the Americans are called the extremist. The Americans are known very much as the hand-on fighters that are very much a military focus, and the Dutch are known to do development. I mean,
well, you talk about the 3D approach: development, diplomacy, governance, mm-hmm. defense, security.
Yes, it's much different than the clear hold and build strategy that the Americans have. And the Dutch also have the approach development and reconstruction where possible, and fighting or military when necessary. So it's kind of like the flip side of the Americans. Are much more likely to go in with a fighting and militarized
approach. The Dutch are running what used to be called, and inaccurately, the hearts and minds approach.
Well, one can argue that, or the Americans would say that they're trying to also win the hearts and minds, but they're likely doing it differently.
What's the response on the ground to the Dutch approach?
It's overall very positive. The Dutch in general are very much liked in Uruzgan, and there are some elders even who are quite hesitant about them leaving, or, you know, because there's a talk about the pullout next year. And overall, everybody says that everybody knows the Dutch do development. And there's a small anecdote that we can say that might explain it. With the Americans, a villager said that when the Dutch or the Australians or some other soldiers come to the villages, only the Taliban take out their guns. When the American come, everybody takes out their guns.
There's a charming little observation you make in the report. One complaint about the Dutch: when we come, they only give us water.
Yes.
The others, you know, give them a bit of a feed and some lollies, but
yes,
the Dutch are a bit abstemious.
Well, the Dutch were laughing.
That's a Calvinist tradition, you see.
Yeah. No, the Dutch were laughing about that too. I think they were saying that, well, if the European think we're stingy, it's okay if the Afghan think we're stingy. It's very much, of course, the tea. And of course, there's something that the Dutch like to consult. They talk a lot. They're known to be much more careful with their money. While the Americans are known that they come with a big suitcases of money, they throw it out, but they don't monitor.
Mm.
So it's unclear at times what really happens with the money. While the Dutch and also the Australians are known that they will monitor, particularly the Australians actually are known to monitor what happens to
I have to say, once again, it sounds very Dutch. You know, with a long tradition of being very careful with the money.
Yes.
Now, from reading your report and from what you've already said, the biggest challenge, or one of them, is to deal with the tribal differences within ethnic groups.
Yes.
And it's symptomatic of the deep problems in the way the Karzai government has been operating.
Yeah. And that's actually particularly because the South is largely, mainly populated by the Pashtun group. And we always hear, of course, that the Pashtuns are the driving force in the insurgency. But it's actually far more complicated than that, because there's different tribes and even confederations among the Pashtuns. And right now there's only one of them in power, which are the Sirak Duranis. And for example, the tribe of Karzai, the Popalsai, in Uruzgan, for example, they're 11% of the entire population, yet their elite controlled politics and resources. So if you kind of see that they, a small minority, controls everything and was able in that process to gatekeep resources to other areas and even like essentially marginalize and alienate them from the both political and economic process.
Now, I understand that members of the tribes that cooperated with the Taliban before 2001, but who weren't necessarily hardcore supporters, have nonetheless been systematically sidelined and aggravated, humiliated.
Yes. What literally happened in Uruzgan, but also some other provinces, we compare to a witch hunt, that everybody who even was marginally associated with the Taliban or was of some tribes that belong where the Taliban was from, even if they themselves may not have done any Taliban activity, were essentially arrested. Their property was taken.
They were tortured, the report.
They were tortured as well. Their private prisons that some of the governors had, and particularly Governor of Uruzgan. And so grievances built up, and those grievances the insurgency can now exploit for their advantage.
Doesn't make a lot of sense, but I was interested too to learn that the Taliban themselves are now modulating or dealing with these sort of complexities internally.
Yes, they are. I mean, first of all, it's hard to say there's the Taliban, because you have an insurgency in there, many groups. And part of them is that we always hear the Quetta Shura, which we call the old guard Taliban, which come from the first regime, you know, which was 96. And then there's a whole new generation of Talibs that come quickly out, like freshly out of madrasas, educated. And then you get a whole, what we tend to call the accidental opportunistic Taliban, which tend to be local leaders who kind of sit on the fence, and then they try to make their choice of what is better for their communities.
And which is going to show the best profit, I guess.
For them, or the best protection, because ultimately right now there is really no protection from...
So protection is more important than the big quid, you think? As a motive?
It's both, you know. I mean, you kind of have to balance. And in many ways, as a leader, you're like a politician. So you could be voted out of office if you don't provide protection or resources to your population. So.
And as you point out, those who are left out of the deals are marginalized and angry. So they're the perfect recruits for the Taliban,
yes.
Plural.
They are that. I think you have three options, you know. You either could just become a loser, stay. You could leave. I mean, and there has been a large population of internally displaced people that have left the areas of fighting. Or you accommodate with the Taliban.
Has the example of the Dutch, the do-no-harm example, the 3D approach, rubbed off on the Australians? Because, of course, they're working pretty closely. You're smiling.
No, I wasn't sure it rubbed off, because I think the Australians already came in with in some parts, a similar approach as well. It's just that they had far, far less people, because the Australians also work very much with an embedded approach. They also work very much with an approach of trying to consult with village elders. So there are some similarities in the Australians.
Of course, Australians are more used to these sorts of activities,
yes.
Even if you look at, say, Ramsay and the Solomons or East Timor, it's not entirely new to them.
No, so I think there's some complementarities between the Dutch and the Australian approach, but the Australians have two kind of forces there. In addition to the provincial reconstruction team, the more like security development forces, they also have special forces which work with the Americans, particularly northern Uruzgan, with the hunt and capture mission of insurgency. And that's where it becomes a bit muddly. You know?
Am I right in thinking that sometimes the Dutch are criticised by their collaborators, their military collaborators, for not fighting enough.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I think in the beginning, even when the Dutch were to take over from the Americans in Oruzgan, they would be made fun of. You know, how can the Dutch go into such an insecure province, you know, when they're hesitant to fight? And then that's a tough stance in the Taliban. But it's just, as said, it's a much different approach. It's a less militarized approach. It's the argument they need long-term development. And there are big debates about it, because there's an argument that nobody has enough military to even fight the insurgency militarily. So it might be better to have a moderate approach to it.
I want to come back to the idea of the Taliban welcoming people from all tribes, in contrast to the Afghan government, which has clearly failed to do so. Tell me about the policies they have on how to deal with tribal conflicts within their ranks.
They try to discourage it, then they try to mediate it. I mean, they have their own court system out there where they're trying to mediate it. They try to recruit quite evenly. I mean,
so they get a tribal balance, you mean?
Yeah, they're parallel. There's something, a shadow government, which is probably different than the Australian shadow government. It's actually far more balanced, but probably the argument in fighter range among the commanders, it's probably a bit less balanced, you know, the people that call the shots, and then the people who probably do the very aggressive missions and the suicide bombing tend to be outsiders.
And of course, they've also got to deal with internal divisions which lead to or reflect traditional cycles of revenge.
Yes, and that's why they actually have a very elaborate, I mean, one of the things the Taliban does bring in when it comes in areas is the justice system, in order to settle conflicts that may have happened between tribes or between individuals. So they have usually a sharia, shura of mullahs that settle disputes.
Do they do so with any degree of humanity, or is it pretty brutal?
Well, I mean, by our standards, it's brutal, but it's swift. So yes, people get hung, you know, people get killed, but ultimately there's an outcome in the justice system, which right now, unfortunately, the government cannot deliver.
This is Alan Nowell on ABC Radio National, abc.net.au/RN, and my guest is Suzanne Schmedel, co-founder and senior advisor to the no longer tribal liaison office in Afghanistan. You still spend about half the year there, don't you?
Yes, this year a bit less, but I go back and forth.
And are you hopeful of any substantial improvement or progress in the situation?
That's a very sad
expression, flickered.
It's a very difficult question because, I mean, the elections, of course, didn't give much hope to many people how they've played out, you know, with fraud, even with the entire conflict within the UN on how to deal with the election. And it's just, it's difficult to really see how to solve a situation that 8 years down the road, you know, have shown little improvement.
I think you have some sympathy for Galbraith.
Well, I have some sympathy for the fact that you should not sell democracy to a country when you cannot deliver it.
Mm. So, in this report, you use the term under the radar, or you apply that to the Dutch. How are the Dutch under the radar?
Well, under the radar is an approach where you try to do very small development project with not a lot of money, so it would attract either insurgency or strongmen. But you try to do it very, very quietly. You know, they have about 600 little projects in villages, about $4,000, where they pay in 4 installments, $1,000 each, and the villagers get to decide what they want. And the Australians have somewhat a bit of similar, but it's not big enough. And the other thing they have done is, for example, in wheat distribution, they worked in areas with Taliban control, and they tried to actually then speak to local Taliban.
Dutch talk to the Taliban. How interesting.
Yes, but I'm sure there's probably others who also talk to the Taliban for different reasons.
Have you observed the Dutch dealing more in a more sophisticated way with that complex web of tribal politics?
Yes, they do a lot of research. I mean, we are one of the organizations or individuals who do research for the Dutch. So they've tried to do the basic do no harm approach, which means you do understanding before engagement. So they really try to understand, not just on the provincial level, but district by district, even village level, who is in power, who are the spoilers to peace, and how should this distribution development be. And they even ask us and others often to monitor whether or not their development assistance is evenly distributed in the province. So it benefits on an even level, and that's what they're known for. And they're known for a bit more neutral. The Americans are known as partial. They're seen as the stooges of the Popa side, or vice versa. The Popa side are seen as the stooges of the Americans in Oregon. So
the Dutch would be seen as relatively clean skin. I would suspect that no one sees them as wanting to stay on and manipulate or profit from or take advantage of Afghanistan.
Yes, that's one of the other advantages they have, that if you ask locals, they say, well, we know the Dutch are not here to stay. They don't have any alternative motive. While of other nations, you hear that. Of the Americans, people have suspicions, their conspiracy theory, that they either even work with the insurgency, that they want to have a base in South Asia for their own strategic benefit. You hear similar things about the British. So,
and the Australians? What's the view on the Australians?
As I say, we've picked up very little about the Australians, and here comes a tricky issue. I mean, their numbers are much less than the Dutch, so it's very possible.
The Dutch is what, about 1,500?
Yeah, so the Dutch are much bigger, so yeah. And the Australian contingent is smaller, and they both work with the Dutch and the Americans. So in some parts, they may be just blended in with the Dutch, and other parts, they will be blended in with the Americans.
It would be more politically advantageous to be blended in with the Dutch.
Probably, yes, yeah. Because it's a more positive view. But I say what we've heard about the Australians is that they deliver what they promise, which is, we haven't even heard the same thing about the Dutch, and that they monitor their projects. So they're very seen as very thorough, and that they stick to their word. And that's very important for Afghans.
I was interested to learn that the local Taliban don't like to fight in their own villages or communities, so they bring in foreign fighters from the Middle East or Pakistan.
I'm not even sure it's a local Taliban who brings them in. It's more like the Quetta Shura, who, when they want to fight in an area, want to take a district, that they bring in the foreign fighters because they know that their local allies will not fight, because the more civilian casualties, again, you have within one area, the less liked you are, which is the same problem the international forces are having. So that's when actually the Quetta Shura, when they built their strategy, decide to bring foreign fighters in, which could be from Pakistan, could be from Saudi Arabia. I mean, there's Arab-speaking, some Uzbek forces, or could be from other areas in Afghanistan. There's a lot of Helmandi Taliban coming to Uruzgan, for example.
What's the Taliban's attitude to the opium crops?
Well, they tax it. So they make a financial benefit from it. There is kind of a relationship in terms of security arrangement with the drug smuggling, you know. So they don't essentially control the drug trade, but they benefit from it. So right now they have a less fair approach on allowing it to happen.
They might be ideologically or religiously opposed, but they have to go along with it.
Yeah, there might be ideology, but I mean, let's face it, the Taliban are also pragmatists when it comes to fighting, and right now it's in their benefit to have the opium trade.
And what on earth would those poor farmers do without that crop?
Well, there are other things that could be done. I mean, when the wheat price had, you know, when there was a wheat shortage internationally, you know, the wheat price had increased, and then the wheat distribution the Dutch had done, there was actually a lot of farmers said, oh, all of a sudden, you know, there's a comparison. So there are other crops, alternative crops. You could do orchards. The Dutch are doing some saffron projects, some smaller crops.
Are they? Yeah.
And the important thing there, though, is whatever crop you do, you have to copy what the opium dealers are doing, which is value chain. You need to not just give people seeds to grow, but you need to make sure that you help the market and sell it. Because when you grow opium, you do nothing. You just have to essentially grow it, and then it's bought off you automatically. You know that you have a sale at the end of the year. And other agricultural products don't have that yet. So if you do that, or even subsidize, let's say if the wheat price drops again, much more farmers would actually switch to legal crops.
One of the valuable things in your report is that it gathers the opinions of locals. We're not used to that.
Yes, it's a big thing we're trying to do. We're talking to the people. We actually use local researchers. We use researchers from the area that we train up. And the most important thing is for us to listen to what people have to say. That's even in the areas where we do development projects, we first ask people what they want. It's a very consultative approach, what the Dutch are also trying to do.
There's so much in this report that requires detailed discussion. I was interested that how little coordination you observe between the foreign forces. They tread all over each other, they send out different messages, they double up, treble up on meetings.
It's a bit of a problem, and it's but particularly a problem, as I was trying to point out, that you still have kind of two different missions in Afghanistan. You still have the coalition forces under Operation Enduring Freedom, who came in 2001 to take down the Taliban, whose main focus is anti-terrorism. They're there to prevent terrorism at home. And then you have the Provincial Reconstruction Team and ISAF, which are kind of the peacekeeping forces under NATO, who are doing security and development and reconstruction. So a lot of the doubling up happens because there are those two different kind of missions. And even so, they are formally under one command now on the McChrystal, you know, one command. They have independent structures, and then you have the special forces who, frankly, nobody really knows what they're doing.
A final question, Suzanne. With the Dutch on the way out, what advice would you have to the Australian government on the way the Australians are deployed and used?
I think they should continue their really embedded approach in terms of talking and listening to the villages of what they want. They need to continue even, and they need to convince the Americans that you need to start focusing on protection of the locals, and they need to do even development that it benefits everybody rather than favoring a small ruling elite.
Well said, Suzanne. Suzanne Schmiedel, co-founder and senior advisor to the Liaison Office in Afghanistan, a particularly interesting contribution to the program, a visiting fellow at the Asia Pacific College on Diplomacy at the Australian National University. Thanks, Suzanne.
Thank you.